This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Along with the rest of the nation, Massachusetts is engaged in a loud debate about guns, gun rights, and how to reduce gun violence. Over the weekend, some 200 supporters of tighter gun control rallied at the State House. It came 1 week after 700 Second Amendment advocates protested gun control legislation being proposed on Beacon Hill.
At the heart of the debate, how to keep guns out of the hands of people like Adam Lanza, who massacred 27 people, including 20 children, at the Sandy Hook Elementary School, and his mother as well, in Newtown, Connecticut. The debate has focused on assault weapons, high-capacity magazines, and how to stop potential killers.
But relatively little is being said about the biggest cause of gun deaths in America, suicides. Leon Nafok wrote about this recently in the Boston Globe in a piece entitled Who Guns Really Kill. You can find a link to his story at radioboston.org.
In that piece, Nafok reports that in 2010, the last year for which complete numbers are available, almost 20,000 people committed suicide with guns in the U.S. 20,000. That compares to 11,000 gun-related homicides. In other words, when it comes to gun deaths, far more are self-inflicted than the result of murder or self-defense.
Which raises a tantalizing idea about how to reduce gun violence. If you can keep guns away from people who are suicidal, you could reduce a huge number of gun deaths, maybe even most of them. Matthew Miller has been studying this issue for a while. He's an associate professor of health policy and injury prevention and deputy director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. And Matthew Miller, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sorry, your title's a mouthful. Sorry for the trip up there. So the takeaway here is far more people use guns to commit suicide than to commit murder. How should that inform the current debate that we're having about gun control and gun rights, in your view?
Well, thank you for having me and for allowing me to talk about the facts that you bring forward. I mean, as Meghna said, there are roughly 19,000 firearm suicides in the United States every year. Half of all suicides in the United States are, in fact, firearm suicides. There are a total of 38,000 suicides overall, more than, in fact, are due to car crashes. That suicide is largely ignored in the public debate, is, I think, ignored at the cost of changing the way people think about the ways that they can prevent suicide in their community and among their family members. The silence has consequences. For example, we know that having a gun in the home is a huge risk factor for suicide, not only for the gun owner, but for every member of the household, for the children in the home, for the wife of the gun owner. Gun owners are often male, and for the gun owner himself. That this risk is not only assumed by the gun owner when they bring a gun to the home, but also imposed on everyone else in the family. Now, it's not imposed willfully. Mm-hmm. It's imposed, in a sense, ignorant of the consequences to members of the family when they decide to bring a gun into the home.
But talk about the significance of that gun being present in the house, because and what all this suggests about how to reduce the number of suicides with guns. Because I could imagine someone hearing this and saying, isn't it true that if a person has decided to take his or her life, they're going to figure out how to do it with or without a gun?
Right. I mean, that's a reasonable hypothesis. And the alternative is, well, if they don't use a gun, perhaps they'll use something else that's not as likely to kill them. The idea that having a gun in the home actually imposes not only short-term risk but long-term risk is based on a couple of well-established clinical observations. One is, it's much more likely you're going to die when you attempt with a gun than with any of the other commonly used methods, such as pills or cutting. You're almost 100 times more likely to die. The second is that most suicidal crises, especially among younger people, are fleeting. Third is that many suicidal acts are impulsive. They're not deliberative acts that you're pursuing until you reach that end. And the fourth, and this is a critical one, is that the prognosis after a suicide that does not result in death is extremely good. More than 90% of people who survive their first suicide attempt do not go on to die by suicide thereafter. So if you save a life in the short run by making it harder for them to reach for a gun in an impulsive act during a fleeting crisis, you're actually saving most lives in the long run.
And what is the data, what does the research say about people who were suicidal, who came through it, and who mm-hmm. are alive today? I mean, do we know anything about that?
Well, we know from some studies of people who as you say, survived a suicide attempt. They were interviewed after the attempt. Let's say they're in a hospital and they made an attempt so serious that but for the medical attention, they would not have survived. Most people say, I'm glad I'm alive. And most people say when asked, well, why did you reach for whatever it is they reached for? And this, let's say a gun, the 10% of people who survive a gun attempt. The reason given the vast majority of the times is, well, it was there. And so we also know when we follow these people over 10, 20, 30 years that fewer than 10% go on to die by suicide thereafter.
So this it seems like there's a key word in here, and that is a suicide crisis being fleeting. So the idea here is if in that fleeting moment you can keep that potentially suicidal person or that suicidal person's hand off the gun, that's pretty much tantamount to saving that person's life.
Yeah, it comes very close. I mean, it's not as though you're going to be able to prevent every suicide.
Right.
But if somebody reaches for pills or reaches for cutting instruments, the chances that they're going to die are less than 2%. And they're over 90% if they reach for a gun.
So given what we know, that what a third of American households have guns, what's the best, the most realistic approach to keeping people away from guns who are suicidal? Because I think that the argument that we just shouldn't have guns in homes, I mean, forget it. That's not going to happen. There's this strong and understandable current of Second Amendment rights in this country. So guns are in homes. What are we going to do about it to prevent suicides?
We're going to try to help people make decisions that, in their own judgment, make them safer rather than imperiling them. So this is not, you know, I'm not a gun control advocate. I am not a political scientist. I'm a scientist. If it turned out that the data said having a gun makes you safer, that's what I would say, you know, that's what I would write about. And when it comes to suicide, the data are really overwhelming that having a gun in the home puts everyone in the home at increased risk for suicide. That it puts everybody in the home at increased risk is actually a really critical observation, because the pushback against some of the studies that have been done at the individual level is that, well, okay, you look at people who died by suicide and you compare them to other people in the same neighborhood who didn't die by suicide. And it turns out there are more guns in the homes of people who died by suicide. If that were the only observation to support the evidence, it would be weak, because you could say, well, the people who were going to commit suicide went out and bought a gun. And that's why when you look at the decedents, you find more guns in those homes. But the fact that it imposes a risk on every other member of the household, those who didn't go out and buy the gun, is one of several pieces of strong information to say, no, this is actually a very strong and likely causal link.
So another potential causal link might be to compare states where access to guns is relatively easy versus states where access to guns not so easy. So what does the data show there?
Yeah, that's a great question, Anthony. If you look at states across the United States, all 50 states, and you ask where are the suicide rates, where do they tend to be highest? What you find is they tend to be highest in areas where there are more guns on average than fewer guns. So we live in Massachusetts, where the gun ownership is at the very low end for the United States as a whole. And we have much lower overall suicide rates. What distinguishes us from places like Mississippi or Montana or other high gun states is that we have far fewer firearm suicides. Our number of non-firearm suicides per capita is not all that different from it is anywhere else. Moreover, our rates of depression, substance abuse, suicidal thoughts, suicide plans, and suicide attempts are not all that different than they are in places where people are killing themselves at three times the rate. The difference in suicide rates really depends largely on the difference in firearm suicides, which is tightly correlated, not surprisingly, with the likelihood that people have guns in their homes.
So going back to this concept of a fleeting crisis and accepting that there are going to be guns in a lot of homes, are there things within that home, the way that gun is stored, trigger locks, whatever it is, that are shown to have an effect of fewer suicides, of decreasing the possibility of a suicide?
There was a really, really interesting study done by David Grossman back in 2005, in which he said, I'm just going to look at households with guns, take out the question of whether a gun in the home increases or doesn't increase the risk of suicide, it's pretty clear it does. Now let me look at exactly the question you're asking. Does the way I store a gun matter? Now, the group of people he looked at were kids and teenagers, 5 to 19 years of age. And so the data we have pertains to that age group. And what he looked at a group of these teenagers who died by suicide and compared them to teenagers who were living in the community and hadn't died by suicide. All the study subjects lived in homes with guns, and the question was, were the guns stored more safely in the homes of the living controls or in the homes of the decedents, or did it really not matter? And it turned out there was an incredibly strong relationship between how safely you stored the gun, locked away, ammunition in a separate place, unloaded, compared to the opposites, loaded, you know, unlocked and whatnot. And so the range of risk was almost threefold, from the most safely stored guns to the least safely stored.
Mm. It's a fascinating set of data that you've brought in. And I'm interested to ask you this, Matthew. You know, we've reported about the New York State Assembly and Governor Cuomo signing into law requirements that all mental health professionals need to report people they consider likely to do harm to themselves and others. Here in Massachusetts, Governor Patrick is proposing that the Department of Mental Health be required to report any information of the Criminal Justice Department on anyone who is committed to a hospital or mental institution. Yet in all of this discussion, I'm not hearing people talk about guns and suicides. Why not?
Well, they should be.
Yeah.
I mean, it's,
but am I wrong about that? I mean, it doesn't seem to be front and center in this conversation, in this national debate.
No, I think you're right that it isn't. And I appreciate the opportunity to perhaps push the conversation a little further and your interest in doing so. But my concern with potentially stigmatizing mental illness is that, first of all, most people who have mental illness are not more likely to be violent. In fact, they're more likely to be victims of violence than they are to perpetrate violence. If you accept out people who have serious substance abuse problems, they're not more likely to be violent at all. Mm. And even if legislation is crafted really narrowly, my concern is that the impression of that legislation might lead some people, for fear of having their guns taken away or having barriers put in the road to acquiring guns, my concern is that they would not seek out mental health care, and I think that would be a real misfortune. Mm. The better way to deal with this is for physicians to feel that it's their obligation and to feel unencumbered in the obligation to speak to their patients about the real and immediate risks of having a gun in the home. And it should, if it gets to a point where I'm your friend and you're having trouble, you're going through a divorce or your kid is moody and depressed, I should be able to go over to you and say, Anthony, you know, I'm concerned about you or your child. I know you have guns in the home. You have them for target shooting. Why don't you leave them at the range? You have it for protection. Why don't we temporarily remove
it? So really similar to the idea that friends don't let friends drive drunk. Well,
yep.
All this relates to the broader discussion and debate about guns and mental health. How should we keep guns out of the hands of people who would not only hurt others but themselves? Are you hearing sensible ideas from our public officials or in our conversation today? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And let me introduce Mary Lou Sutters. She's the former Massachusetts Commissioner of Mental Health and an associate professor at Boston College's Graduate School of Social Work. And Mary Lou Sutters, thanks for coming in, and thanks for sitting patiently through the first part of that conversation.
Oh, no, it's a fascinating conversation. I think people forget that more people die from suicide than homicide in the United States.
Yeah, well, what's your reaction to what you heard there from Matthew Miller? It's a really interesting and compelling set of statistics.
Well, we know how effective and lethal guns are. And if you had someone that you cared about, just picking up something that you said, is that if you knew someone had guns in their house and they were depressed or going through some situational issue, as a caring friend, you would go over and say, I'm acknowledging what you're going through. I care about you. Let me take your guns, lock them up, do something with them. Mm. It's a different kind of gun control. It's really a caring statement to that individual that you care about them, you acknowledge the pain that they're experiencing, and you want them to get treatment. And part of that is then taking away some of those taking away the guns at that moment so that they cannot engage in a lethal, impulsive act. Mm. And that is one of the things we know about suicide, particularly around young people, is the impulsivity of that act. So again, I think that that is that's not part of this conversation.
And I'd really like to ask you about, you know, there's been a lot of coverage recently on New York State's new law, which requires all mental health professionals to report people they consider likely to do harm to authorities. It also gives law enforcement officials the power to take guns away from those people. Would that help this situation? Do you have concerns about that kind of legislation?
I have significant concerns with the legislation. I think it focuses on, I think it really focuses on the wrong issue. We need to have a really multifaceted approach to reducing violence in our communities. As the other guest said, people with mental illnesses are more likely to be the victims than the perpetrators. Frankly, if we're going to have a different kind of conversation around who should have guns in Massachusetts, and I'll speak only about Massachusetts, you know, I could see if you went down to apply for a gun permit that you had to sign a release saying my medical records and my psychiatric and my addiction records were subject to be released to the local police chief. That could be a deterrent for someone. Mm. That, to me, is a more positive way to approach sort of this issue. I worry about the unintended consequences of driving people away from accepting mental health treatment. And I think that that is one of the concerns I have about New York State.
Mm. You agree with that, Matthew. You're nodding your head. Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious, though, here in Massachusetts, because one of the things Governor Patrick wants to do is to require that mental health information be submitted to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, which a lot of states do. And at first blush, it sounds like common sense, but your concern is that this would stigmatize people.
It's absolutely stigmatizing. And also the Department of Mental Health actually has responsibility for very few individuals who are involuntarily psychiatrically hospitalized. Most people in Massachusetts are involuntarily psychiatrically hospitalized in private psychiatric hospitals or general hospitals with inpatient units. So the Department of Mental Health actually has a very small piece of that pie in terms of involuntary hospitalizations. But again, I think, you know, step back here a moment. We need to engage in a very different conversation. Mm. One is to identify individuals who identify and intervene earlier with people with serious mental illnesses and have a very different treatment strategy for people who have first episodes of psychotic illnesses, which in other countries is very effective. And we're not having that conversation. Instead, what we're talking about is who cannot have a gun permit or a gun in Massachusetts.
It seems like you're talking about treatment. The proposed legislation is a lot about reporting, reporting, reporting.
That's right. Our mental health system, frankly, our public mental health system across the country is in shambles. We don't provide the services, the effective services and treatments for individuals to get identified, treated, and able to get on with their lives. And that's sort of my focus.
Well, listeners, you can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're talking about the best way to keep guns away from people who might hurt themselves and others, with a sort of focus on the whole mental illness piece of this conversation. Michael Bernstein writes on Facebook, "I miss my college roommate Alex, and the world is poorer for his absence. Had he not had easy access to a gun, he might not have taken his own life." So that's one of the issues. That's really the big issue that we're talking about right now. Let's go to Joel, who's calling from Jamaica Plain. Hi, Joel. You're on the air.
Hi. There are these things called trigger locks, and some of them are automatic in the sense that they can only fire for the people to whom they are encoded. Others have regular keys. If there were a regulation requiring people storing quantities of guns at home to employ these trigger locks, that might be conceivably quite helpful.
Joel, thanks for the...
Another point.
Yeah, go ahead, Joel. Sorry.
Is that to drive a car or a truck or a motorcycle, whatever, you've got to demonstrate skill, competence, and basic reliability as a citizen, like you haven't been, and there could be the same requirement to purchase or to own a gun, perhaps the requirement to take a short safety course, But why should anybody just be able to? Why should we not, as a body politic, be able to insist on the appropriate people only?
Well, Joel, this is a big part of the debate that's been on the table, and I appreciate you bringing it to our attention. Matthew, do you want to comment on anything you heard Joel say? I mean, particularly about the trigger locks, because it seems like, as you mentioned earlier, there's data to suggest that that can save lives.
Yeah, I think Joel has pointed to an important second best option. Mm-hmm. You know, we know from methodologically sound studies that the way to reduce risk most is to remove the gun from the home, period, full stop. But if you think you need to have a gun or want to have a gun and have taken the risks into account, the next best step is to store the gun safely, as I said earlier. It's important in thinking about storing the gun safely that you make sure you do it in a way that doesn't allow other people to get access to it. I did a study with then a medical student, Francis Baxley, which looked at children in homes with guns. And we asked the parents, do you think your child knows where the gun is? And do you think your child has ever played with the gun without adult supervision? And it turns out that of the parents who said, no, there's no way that my child knows where a gun is, they were wrong most of the time. And of those who said, there's no way my child would play with a gun, would touch it without an adult around, I've taught them that. They've gone to safety classes. No, they know better. Mm-hmm. What we found is when you ask the child, separate from the parent, the answer is, well, often, in fact, they do know how to get into the safe. They do know how to open it, and they do play with it. So the key here is if you're going to lock your guns away, you have to do it in a way that makes it impossible for your child to get access to the gun. It's not a child's responsibility to make the house safe. You know, they're kids. They're not small adults. It's the parents' responsibility to make sure that that's it's secure.
And Mary Lou Sutters, you know, you've said that you hope that this tragedy in Newtown will change the conversation in this country around mental health. What do you want that? How do you want that conversation to change?
Well, one is that we stop. First of all, we say the mentally ill as if it's a homogeneous group. Mental illness affects 1 in 4 American adults. It is an illness. It is treatable. The conversation we've been having so far, I worry that we stigmatize all people with mental illnesses as being violent. And we know that that is just not true. What I would hope the conversations that we can have is that at the school level, teachers partner with families when a child starts to exhibit some behaviors that may be a mental health issue. For kids who are between the ages of 15 and 24, which is when they are most at risk of developing a psychotic illness, that we identify the symptoms earlier. We don't wait 2-3 years before someone may be treated, and they're treated episodically rather than in a comprehensive way. Other countries have figured this out, so I know that we can do that in the United States. And the last thing I'd say is that instead of pushing people away from the system, that we provide the treatment strategies that bring them into the system.
All right, Mary Lou Sutters, former Massachusetts Commissioner of Mental Health. She's an associate professor at Boston College's Graduate School of Social Work. Thanks so much, as always, for coming in and sharing your thoughts with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And Matthew Miller, he's an associate professor of health policy and injury prevention at Harvard. He's deputy director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. Matthew Miller, thanks for bringing in that really interesting data on guns and suicide. We appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us, listeners. The conversation continues at RadioBoston.org. And coming up, Ralph Ellison's iconic American novel, Invisible Man, is adapted for the stage. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.